Hi, this is Donna Sebo, and welcome to an hour of Mind Power. I'm so delighted to be able to be with you today. We've got a gorgeous, gorgeous environment around us here up in the Pacific Northwest, where this broadcast is originating from. And I hope wherever you are, the sun is shining just as brightly and beautifully on you as it is on me. As always, we have wonderful guests, and we are going to be talking with a man who has traveled the world. Now, before we go to Perry Garfinkel, who is my guest, I want to give to you our toll-free telephone number. Should you want to call in and chat with me later on in the hour, this is the number to call. Write it down, 877-876-5227. That's 877-876-5227. Perry Garfinkel is my guest. This is a man who has been a contributor to the New York Times since 1986. He's also been very much involved with the National Geographic and, oh, so many other publications. He has traveled around the world, and I love one sentence about Perry. He says, "I've been falling on and off the meditation cushion for just about as long as I've been involved in writing." In his wonderful book, Buddha or Bust, is what we're going to be talking about today, In Search of Truth, Meaning, Happiness, and the Man Who Found Them All. Perry, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Well, it is an absolute delight. Can you tell me, please, where we are talking to you?
I am actually on the island of Martha's Vineyard, where I live year-round.
Ah.
And it's a beautiful afternoon here.
Well, I just think it's gorgeous across the country. And, of course, we have listeners from around the world, which I really feel is awesome. And you have had such an interesting background. I mean, there are not that many people, for all of our flexibility with traveling, that have the opportunity to go all around the world, interact with different cultures. What was the stimulus for you to evolve into this arena of writing, communication, photography? I know I've got listeners that would just be mentally salivating, saying, "Oh, this is wonderful. I'd love to do what he said."
Yeah, yeah, it's a dream job, except the part where you sit down and have to write, you know. You know, there's a line I use when I teach writing workshops. I say, "I hate to write, but I love to have written."
Uh-huh.
But I think what has always driven me is this need, a desire to communicate one-to-one. And, you know, as a journalist, you know, I was trained to not use I, me, or my, you know, as you write in the third person.
Mm-hmm.
For the first, I'd say, 10 years of my writing career, I worked for newspapers, and I learned to kind of be objective about myself. And then I was able to bring myself in and write about my own, you know, my own experience, but only to the degree that I see myself as a character, an everyman, like shared feelings that
mm-hmm.
I have the ability to express that other people are saying, yeah, yeah.
Well, your travels, again, have provided the opportunity for you to go into wonderfully exotic places. At least in the minds of many of us, we'd sit there and we might watch a documentary on television and say, "Oh, wow, wouldn't that be a wonderful place to visit?" And I know there's all kinds of things that go on behind the scenes that nobody ever knows about. And often it takes a long time to get photography, especially like for the National Geographic. And I have such an appreciation for that publication that's been out for so many years, because of the awesome photography and the detail that goes into the stories.
And the writing is very arduous work. For every sentence you read in that magazine, there are hours of research and, you know, contemplation. And believe me, it's a dream job. I freelance, but I was on this assignment writing my book, Buddha or Bust, and the Geographic has sent me around the world to follow in the tracks of Buddhism. And there were days where I just pinched myself and said, "I can't believe I'm in Sri Lanka." As just saying the word is, you know, evokes paradise. And
mm-hmm.
and then, you know, on the trail of this very fascinating story, I was, you know, being forced to kind of examine, you know, things within myself that I was even surprised about.
Now, when you formed this expedition, because you presented a proposal to National Geographic to be able to do this historical journey. And you say that you had organized the expedition with a chronology of Buddhism in mind.
Correct. I think I had the rare opportunity to, millions of people have walked in the footsteps of the Buddha, and that certainly was part of my own journey, to walk where he walked, get enlightened where he got enlightened, or at least try. And then I had this rare experience to chart and follow the migration of Buddhism as it left India and went south to Sri Lanka, or north across Tibet, and crisscrossed Asia, Southeast Asia, and eventually ended up in China. And I could pick out 9 countries to stop in on this round-the-world adventure. And as it turned out, for the most part, I did kind of follow the course of the history of Buddhism, and I saw how it morphed and changed and adapted to each culture it, you know, moved into. And here now in America, you know, Buddhism is on the rise, you could say. It's a Buddha boom.
A Buddha boom.
But, Buddha boom.
I make
Buddha
a song out of that title. I love some of the words that you put in here. You are so straightforward in so much of what you present. And you talk about a period in your life, July 2003, for example. And you have this one sentence. Your mother was a very special person in your life, but
still is.
Yes, and your life wasn't really going too well at that time. And you said one of the things that kept coming back to you was your mother's mantra.
Uh-oh.
It's, Perry, you don't have a pot to piss in. I couldn't avoid that. I had to share that.
Can we say that on the radio?
Well, we did.
Bless
moms. I mean,
well,
it's
a common phrase, and it's part of our vernacular, isn't it? And
yes,
we all know what it means. And you know, there was that period of my life, I was kind of giving up. And it's funny, Adana, as my understanding of Buddhism evolved, and I kind of saw that why was Buddhism rising in popularity. I should backtrack, right, and say what happened to your listeners is my back went out at a point where I was very low in my, you know, career, and I was unsure about relationships, and nothing was working for me. And then my back almost too symbolically went out.
Mm-hmm.
And that was ground zero of my beginning journey, so to speak, in the footsteps of the Buddha. But I had lost faith in faith. You know, I'd really lost the faith in myself to bootstrap myself, and on another level, lost faith in the faith-based systems, you know, of the Judeo-Christian traditions that I grew up in. And as I came to understand Buddhism, I think that's part of the reason Buddhism is popular. There's people who have lost faith in faith discover that Buddhism isn't about a faith. It's much more empirical and kind of practical than most people understand and realize. And I think that's partly why it's appealing now, is you can believe in this tradition and this philosophy, almost a science of mind, but there is no necessity, you know, you don't have to make that gap to believing the Red Sea parted, or, you know, all
mm-hmm.
the magical things we read about in the Old and the New Testament.
Well, you have so many different, again, very significant sentences that really stood out with me. And one was after you had gotten, here you are at this very, very low period in your life. Everything is just going awry. You're in your pity pot. You really are doing a good job of staying there. And then there's these shifts that occur, and at the National Geographic job that allowed you to begin this unique journey. And you have these words, I was sprinkled with magic dust. And here's your life just transforming. Yet it was not without its work, and was not without its, you know, its demands upon you. Yet here you had to do so much research. Where did you begin your research of the history?
Well, that's a very good question, and it was almost daunting to look at a history of a religion that goes back 2,500 years, and then, by the way, discover it's not a religion. But my research began as you started this show. I had been falling off and on, you know, meditation cushions for 30 years. So my own personal experience as one of the, pilgrims through the 70s of looking for, you know, the new age, or, you know, personal growth and the human potential movement. I kind of traveled that whole circuit in the late 60s and 70s. I guess I am a seeker of truth. And this was like the Buddha himself. He had been in a period in history called the Axial Age, and which is kind of similar to ours. But in answer to your question, you know, first I introspected and asked a lot of questions. And then I, extended my networks of professors of Buddhism, people I had known for 30 years who have now become pretty famous in the American Buddhist scene, and Daniel Goleman, the author of Emotional Intelligence, who I'm sure your listeners know of. And I went and had reunions with all these people and asked, the driving question was, why does it seem Buddhism has grown in popularity in the West? And is there a reason for this? And who was this enigmatic guy called the Buddha, whose statues of him are on mantles and fireplaces in very upscale houses in, Bel Air, California. And it's more like an ornament than really a religious icon. But this Buddhism thing has penetrated our culture to the point that I saw one study, Donna, that said 1 in 8 Americans say that they have been influenced by Buddhist readings or practice. That's something like 35 million people. So I just kind of followed the thread, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I do. Now, you have a quote by L.A. Weisel. I have learned two lessons in my life. First, there are no sufficient literary, psychological, or historical answers to human tragedy, only moral ones. Second, just as despair can come to one another only from other human beings, hope, too, can be given to one only by other human beings. That was a very powerful quote for your chapter of Finding the Buddha's Truth of Suffering in Poland. Here you are in Poland. I mean, Asia, we understand. Poland?
I know, it sounds like the setup for a bad joke.
I mean, it's amazing. Here you are doing this trip, and you're going into some of the most unlikely places. Now, tell us why Poland was significant.
Well, you should know that the other thread of my story for National Geographic and the book, Buddha or Bust, is that I was looking for examples of what's now called socially engaged Buddhism, and everything from Zen hospice programs to prison reforms with actual meditation retreat centers in the prison, examples like that around the world. And there was a guy named Bernie Glassman, who used to be an aeronautical engineer, and got into Zen Buddhism and became a priest in the Zen tradition, and started this practice of a meditation retreat at Auschwitz. And I thought, well, this is off my chronology to go to Poland when I thought I'd start my story right where the Buddha was born. But we're better or worse, as I say in my book, to see suffering, which is one of the kind of core bones to gnaw on in Buddhism. Why do we suffer? Where does this come from? How do we assuage it? And how do we learn how to be happy? But sitting there at Auschwitz, and it was really moving for me, Don, especially because from my mother's side, we're all Polish, and I'm Jewish, and we had lost family in the Holocaust.
Mm-hmm.
And to kind of come to some Buddhist equanimity without anger, as Ellie says, or without hostility. Would you read that other quote from the Buddha that I, connect to Ellie there?
Well, let's see. Here it is. Holding on to anger is like grasping a hot coal with the intent of throwing it at someone else. You are the one that gets burned.
That is so powerful. And juxtaposing it against Elie Wiesel, says so much that, what is the point of holding on to the anger at, instances like the Holocaust or World War III or what's going on in the Middle East right now? If we could come to a mutual understanding, we would probably, be able to alleviate all this anger and the retaliation and the eye for an eye. It doesn't really get us anywhere. And that's what, in fact, that my whole experience at Auschwitz taught me, that there's no point in remaining angry. It only hurts yourself.
Oh, I think that that is so true. Now, for those of you that have just tuned in to the interview, my guest today is Perry Garfinkel. His wonderful book is Buddha or Bust, In Search of Truth, Meaning, Happiness, and the Man Who Found Them All. It's a lot about history. And Perry has done so much traveling and having tickets to go around the world to do the research for the National Geographic regarding the history of Buddhism and how it is involved in the world today was really quite an accomplishment. I, again, have such an appreciation for your sense of humor, Perry, because I'm this chapter that you're where you say you're in the land of the Buddha's birth, and you talk about certain aspects regarding the history of Buddha, but you said you could have imagined being hired to write the promo copy, see the inspirational Kmart, Maha Bodhi Temple, sit under the world-famous Microsoft Bodhi Tree. You come up with these things in your book, and it just makes you chuckle. You have a marvelous, marvelous way of giving out such descriptive points of information and these conversations with people, and then you throw in these little gems of modern-day advertising style.
Did I tell them about that? I was just the night before I went to make my final, you know, pitch meeting with the National Geographic, I was still in a quandary and not sure my, you know, my proposal was solid and my premise was, you know, right on. And I'm watching a commercial on TV, and it was a Taco Bell commercial, but it was promoting enchilada nirvana. And nirvana, of course, is the, you know, the ancient language name for enlightenment that the Buddha attained. But my whole point was that this Buddhism had permeated our culture to such a degree that it's become accepted and adapted, but we don't know really what it is. And I think there's a lot of misunderstandings about Buddhism, about, you know, it's not about levitation and, you know, it's not kind of airy-fairy kind of stuff. It's, in fact, one of the Buddhist scriptures is called Abhidhamma, which translates to science of mind. And what the Buddha did was kind of deconstruct his mental thought processes to understand why his own mind led him to unhappiness and how it could, if he didn't learn how to redirect it, lead him to happiness. And so he did what I call the world's first self-psychoanalysis 2,500 years before the Buddha. And he attained this enlightenment under the Bodhi tree, which is now a big tourist attraction. And I did imagine that, the Indian government, now that it sees Buddhism is, dare I say, sexy, they'll, you know, figure out a way to market it.
As it is just with about everything in this world, isn't that the truth?
Yeah, and I should throw in here that I had the incredible opportunity to interview the Dalai Lama, and we could talk about that. But what he said was, I asked him, what do you think about the Madison Avenueization of Buddhism? And he looked at his interpreter like, what does this mean? But they both giggled and they understood. And he said basically, Buddhism is bigger than Madison Avenue. So, you know, a skincare line called Zen and a MP3 player called Karma, you know, this could be the kind of dissolution or the, you know, dilution of Buddhism. But he said, you know, if these words like this infiltrate the culture, somebody, you know, will say, what does this mean, really, Karma?
Mm-hmm.
And you, or the band called Nirvana, and you know, some kid is going to go say, what is Nirvana? And then they will begin to read a little about, you know, a practice that is very, very valuable asset, you know, to anybody in any religion.
Well, you bring up two people in your book that I was fascinated with. It was Albert and Tim Leary, and they were both psychology professors at Harvard in the 60s, and Timothy Leary was known worldwide for his unique behavior, and they both were dismissed for submitting psychology grad students to experiments with LSD. And Albert later embraced Hinduism and came to be known as Ram Dass, which many of my listeners will know very, very well.
Uh-huh.
And he also ended up being one of your teachers, you said.
Yes, it was a sort of one of those funny, shall I say, karmic coincidences because I first started contributing to the whole East-West journalism scene to a magazine called East-West Journal, and the first issue I saw had Ram Dass on the cover, and my then-wife and I had just come back from India because we had read Ram Dass's first book, which so many people know, called Be Here Now. And this was our, you know, our ticket to ride, so to speak, in India. And his through a long, circuitous route of through this magazine I became involved with, I got to know him personally, and he was a teacher of mine for a year or two. The great irony, Donna, is Harmony Books published Be Here Now, you know, when it first came out, and it was really an underground bestseller.
Mm-hmm.
And Harmony Books is the publisher of Buddha or Bust, and so I feel like my own journey has come full circle, too.
One of the points that you bring out is that in doing this research and this history, that in our world today, someone like the Buddha doing the disciplines that he decided to do, we might institutionalize him, thinking he's mentally unbalanced.
Right.
And this was 2,500 years ago. And
well, he went through these austerities that just like self-flagellation. Really on the border of, you know, just, you know, masochism. Yeah.
And then he found none of that was valuable. It didn't have any purpose.
Right. He found it was giving him a headache and he was dying, literally.
Yeah.
And then he had a little, you know, epiphany that the story is that he had a memory of himself as a baby and he kind of went into some natural trance state. And I, when I read this, I related to this because I remember my daughter, who's now 29. The kids do that, don't they? They just kind of go into like almost a staring stupor.
Mm-hmm.
And he realized that kind of state approached what he was, you know, trying to find through these austerities. And he thought to himself, "I'm trying too hard. It shouldn't be this hard." And if the opulent life, he was a prince and a son of a powerful king and lived in luxury most of his life, I mean, until he was 29 before he went out to go find some way to deal with human suffering. But he realized, okay, too much indulgence doesn't work and too much austerity doesn't work. Maybe there's a middle way, and it's been called the middle path, which is this kind of delicate balance between, you know, striving for something but not being attached to the outcome of it.
Mm-hmm. It's really fascinating. One of the stories that you share, which I really, really like, and I've heard different versions of this over the years, it was about Buddha and a monk approaching a river and seeing a woman washing some clothes along the bank, and they reached her, and she asked if they could help her ford the river. Tell us the rest of that story.
Yeah, the Buddha and the monk approach a river and they see a woman washing her clothes and she's got her laundry bag and she asks them to help her across the river and lift her up on their back. People should know that Buddhists are not supposed to touch women. But the Buddha said, "Please, sure, I would love to." And he hoists her up and carries her over, puts her down at the side of the on the other side of the river and continues on the path. And his brother, monk, looked very agitated and irritated, and the Buddha finally said, "Brother, what's wrong?" And the monk said, "You know, Lord, you touched a woman, you know, that's sacrilege in our tradition, and you picked her up and you carried her across." And the Buddha turned to him and said, "Yes, brother, I did pick her up and carry her across, but I put her down back there and you're still carrying her."
Mm-hmm.
And why I love that story is it resonates in so many other ways to all of our lives, whether it's emotional baggage you're still holding on to, you know, desires or, you know, things you're trying to do. And, you know, it's that attachment, literally, that if we try too hard to, you know, follow the rules, you play that game of it's almost like you're punishing yourself by not being the perfect, you know, person. And sometimes, you know, you just have to do what might seem wrong and put it down and keep walking on and let it go. Not be held back by mistakes from your past.
you traveled again around the world on this journey of research. And for those of you listening, again, I'm interviewing Perry Garfinkel. Buddha or Bust is his book. Believe me, you'll go around the world with this man and just see so much of what he's experienced. The writing is just great. You ended up at one point in Thailand, and there was a 71-year-old gentleman, and I hope I don't butcher his name, Sivaraska? Is that the correct pronunciation, S-I-V-A-R-A-K-S-A, or is it Sivaraska?
No, Sivaraska.
Sivaraska, okay.
Yes.
Tell us about this man. He has twice been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. He won in 1995 the Right Livelihood Award, also known as the Alternative Nobel Peace Prize.
Right. He was one of about, I'd say, half a dozen great men who I had the great opportunity to interview. Sulak Sivaraksa is head of a movement called the International Network of Engaged Buddhists, which is based in Bangkok, and he's been an activist, very much in the tradition of what I wanted to find, you know, social engagement on,
mm-hmm.
on every level, environmental and the political and, you know, educationally. And Sulak is a very powerful man who is very humble, and he still lives on his family's farm, but now it's surrounded by all of Bangkok. But he is among, you know, the men I interviewed, and he sent me to an interesting thing, Donna, to observe an ordaining. They're called ecology monks, and these ecology monks ordain trees by wrapping saffron ribbons around them to protect them from being clear-cut by illegal logging industry. And people should know that in Thailand, 95% of the population are Buddhists, so nobody would cut down a tree that had been ordained, even in a mock way, as a monk. You know, that would be, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a, you know, it's a kind of like a demonstration, like a kind of like the Thai people's rainforest action network. And these are the kinds of things Sulak has been spearheading for many years now in Thailand. So, you know, the third world, it's Southeast Asia, which is one of the, you know, the bedrocks of Buddhism. So I saw glimpses of this social engagement there going on as well.
You ended up going to Japan. You met with the Dalai Lama. You have encountered so many wonderful people in this journey, and I know we're close to finishing our time together today. What thought would you like to leave my listeners? What was the one of the most powerful things that you obtained as a gift from this journey of research and photography and communication with so many people?
What I've concluded after my own 3 years of doing this and watching people doing, you know, looking for truth, meaning, happiness, and enlightenment for years and years and years, is the same thing the Buddha learned about when he realized himself as a little child. Enlightenment is just a breath away. That what the Buddha means, awakened. And when he attained enlightenment, he had a breath. There was a moment when he took one breath and realized, and became realized, you know, awake, as it's called, enlightened. And I realized that, you know, this practice of a breath meditation is such a powerful thing to help you focus your mind. And also, you know, we all know now about cardiovascularly, it helps reduce stress and, you know, heart rate. And yoga and meditation are just great, you know, for the psychology, the mind and the body. And I realize that now I've gotten good enough that if I take a breath in and out in the middle of traffic, in the middle of an argument with somebody I really care about, I have that moment where I put it in perspective. And everything is impermanent. This moment will pass and this feeling will pass. And it brings me back to, it gives me a tool to find a little peace even in the chaos of the modern world.
Now, Perry, I know we're out of time. It's been absolutely delightful having you as a guest. What is your website if people want to find out more about your journeys?
Yeah, if you can't find my book in bookstores or on Amazon, go to buddhaorbust.com. It's all one word, www.buddhaorbust.com.
Thanks so much.
This has been a great interview. Thank you very much.
Oh, it is my pleasure. And I know you've got to go, so go ahead and hang up that phone, and we're just going to know that wherever you go, whatever new journeys you'll be experiencing, you'll just Have joy with all of them, and we'll look forward to seeing more of your wonderful writing.
Thank you, Donna.
You're welcome, Perry. This is Donna Sebo, and my guest has been Perry Garfinkel. His wonderful book, Buddha or Bust, In Search of Truth, Meaning, Happiness, and The Man Who Found Them All. If you're interested in the history and you want to travel around the world, boy, it's the most inexpensive opportunity you will ever have, and the joy and delight that you will be experiencing from reading his wonderful stories and the interview with the Dalai Lama, etc., will be something that you will carry for a long time. This is Donna Sebo. We are having some technological problems today, so we will not be breaking away for our commercials, but I'm going to be chatting with you about some wonderful things that are going on. And, of course, you know, and some of you I've had the privilege of meeting out at the Washington State Renaissance Fantasy Fair. It has just been absolutely awesome. Oh, I've got to share something with you. Last year at the Renaissance Fair, we had a huge wedding that was done out there, and all of the wedding party was garbed in their Renaissance, you know, attire. And it was a large party. It was well over 100 people that had come out to do this wedding. And I had the privilege of meeting the bride and the groom, and it was just wonderful. So this past weekend, the bride and groom came back. Yes, at the Renaissance Fantasy Fair, they came back because they made a vow that every year at the same time on their anniversary here in the month of August, they were going to come back and just have a special moment of memory regarding the beautiful wedding that they did last year. And so I had a chance to talk to the bride, and it was just absolutely wonderful to renew those memories and to know how much fun there is here at this event. Now, we've got 1 weekend left, and if you'd like to come along, hey, all you have to do is go into the website WashingtonRenFair.com. That's WashingtonRenFair.com. And you can go there, you can get your tickets in advance, and it saves you money, and even more valuable, it saves you time. You don't want to stand in the long line. We had tens of thousands of people that came out this past weekend, and my goodness, they had to stand in line waiting. Those people that had gotten their tickets off the internet didn't. Now, if this is your first time hearing about this wonderful festival here in the state of Washington, actually in the Gig Harbor area, the location is the Mentor Creek Ranch. You will walk up after you park your car, you'll walk through the gates of the castle, and you'll see people just dressed to the nines. You'll see Muddy Mary, you'll see fairies, you will see all kinds of characters that are portraying themselves with certain stories to go along with their costume, their attire, and it is magical. I can't tell you how much fun it is just to watch the faces of the children and the adults when you see the knights go walking by in all of their armor, and they have their swords, and they're dressed to the nines. It's absolutely wonderful, and the ladies in their lovely gowns, and you have people from all different representations. You have some people that are merchants. It's wonderful, and you are going to be able to find products from all over the world. I was visiting one of the merchants yesterday, and they had shoes from India, all handmade and beautifully designed with gold threads, silver, beads, just gorgeous, gorgeous things. So it's a chance to step back into history, and if you want to come in costume, you can come in costume. Hours are from 10 to 6 on Saturday and Sunday, and our last weekend is coming up. It's just an awesome experience, so I hope you will come. And remember, all you have to do is go to their website, WashingtonRenFair.com, and don't forget to put the E on the end of the word fair, because it is truly a magical experience, and the weather is going to be just awesomely fabulous. So hope to see you there. And stop by my booth. I have a canopy, and on the sides of my canopy, you'll see huge golden yellow banners with vivid, bright red aristocratic lions on the side. Just know you can come on in and say hello, and I'll be delighted to meet with you. And this is Donna Sebo. Telephone lines are going to be open, 877-876-5227. That's 877-876-5227. Now, I have in front of me some material, and I wanted to share it with you. First of all, I want to express my appreciation to a listener who is in Thailand, and they sent me a very lovely note saying appreciation. They really appreciated my thoughts. They enjoy my newsletter, and that they get a special lift from what they receive. And that meant a lot to me. You know, we're listened to around the world, around the world. And I never in my wildest dreams ever thought that this is where I would find myself on internet radio. But here I am, and I'm so glad that you're going to be able to hear me and tell your friends about the show. And don't forget, if you would like to get my newsletter, go ahead, go on into my website, which is www.delphiinternational.com, delphiinternational.com, and then you will be able to go into the newsletter side. There's buttons that you'll find on the left side of the home page. And just go in and visit. You're welcome to peruse through any and all areas of my website. On the newsletter portion, you'll have the newsletter for the month of August, but we have also archives of all the newsletters that have been done. So you're invited to go and review any of those that you would like, because each month I have a different theme. And I invite you to do that. Also, I want you to know that there is a button on the left side of that screen that talks about glyconutrients. And this, to me, is very, very significant and very important. Why, you ask? Because in finding out about glyconutrients, which I only became aware of earlier this year, I've become understanding of a whole new level of nutrition that I did not know existed, and it does. Research and technology during the last 20 years have made discoveries regarding nutrition, and I invite you to go to my website, tap on that button, glyconutrients, and it'll take you to a page of information that I hope you'll take the time to read and review. And then there's another site that you can go visit. And if you have any questions about the glyconutrients, give me a buzz. At my office, the toll-free number is 800-872-8852. And I'll be glad to answer any questions you might have about it. Taking care of our health is very important. And there's not a day that goes by that I'm not talking with someone who is either sharing with me some difficulties they have, or they're wanting to find a way to keep themselves more healthy or to keep their family healthier. And I think that that's important to all of us because we want to live vitally productive lives, don't we? So I encourage you, won't you stop by my website, tap on that glyconutrient button, stop by that page, read it, and see if you'd like to find out more. If so, again, don't hesitate to give me a call at my office number, 800-872-8852. That's 800-872-8852. Now, I know so many of you, and by the way, we are having some technical problems, so I'm not going to be taking any breaks, but I will be going straight through for the full hour. I want to thank Faye, who out of Virginia sent me an email, and I had to share it with you, because back there, I guess in Virginia, they're just cooking. So she sent me an email saying, it's so hot. Now, you know it's hot when the birds have to use potholders to pull worms out of the ground. The trees are whistling for the dogs. The best parking place is determined by shade instead of distance. Hot water now comes out of both taps, and you can make sun tea instantly. You learn that a seatbelt buckle makes a pretty good branding iron. The temperature drops below 95 degrees, and you feel a little chilly. You discover that in July it only takes two fingers to steer your car, and also that you can get sunburned through your car window, and you can actually burn your hand by opening the car door. You know it's hot when you break into a sweat the instant you step outside at 7:30 a.m. Your biggest bicycle wreck fear is, what if I get knocked out and end up lying on the pavement and cooked to death? You realize that asphalt has a liquid state. The potatoes cook underground, so all you have to do is pull one out and add butter, salt, and pepper. And farmers are feeding their chickens crushed ice to keep them from laying hard-boiled eggs. And the cows are giving evaporated milk. That's hot. Anyway, thanks to Faye and Virginia. Those are little cute items that I think that's just fun. And having a good sense of humor about these warm temperatures, because I find it so much fun when the seasons begin to change. You know, here in the Pacific Northwest, we are accustomed to very temperate weather. And so when it gets above 75, that's when we start complaining. And then when it gets into the 80s, we complain a little bit louder. And then when it gets into the 90s, which is very rare here in the Pacific Northwest, then you hear loud complaining. Hardly anybody here has air conditioning, for heaven's sakes. We don't need it that often. But boy, do we complain. And then on the other side of the coin, when it starts getting cooler, then you hear people complaining about the cool weather. You can't win. So wherever you are, just remember, you're just so fortunate, you're blessed to have the sunshine out. Enjoy it. Keep cool. Have fun. And more than anything else, don't overdo. Remember, when the temps get really hot, a good thing to do is to take a siesta. The Italians have it right. The people in Spain have it right. You know, in Spain during the summer, what they do, they close everything down from 2 until 5. It's siesta time. And that's pretty much what's done in Italy, in certain parts of Italy as well. And in South America, it's something that is typically done because it's too cotton-picking hot. You don't want to be out moving around. So remember that. There's a reason that you stay calm and sort of cool and you don't push yourself when the weather gets really, really hot. You're not supposed to. It's just not the right thing to do. Now, speaking of summer and the fact that we need to be aware of the temps and we need to be aware of the sun, there is a lady by the name of Julie, and she had some really personally enlightening lessons brought to her relative to the sun and being savvy. She had gone to her dermatologist, and she had asked about the moles that she had noticed that were developing, and she said she, 11 years earlier, she had been diagnosed with a particular type of a basal cell skin cancer. And so she said it was just routine. Every year I would go back to the dermatologist and just say, well, give me a checkup, see if, how it's doing. So nothing had happened for 11 years. And her dermatologist, in noticing certain things, said, okay, you've been coming in once a year now. Now I want you to come in at once every 3 months. Well, Julie's heart fell right down into the middle of her stomach. You can imagine what her feelings were. First was fear, what's wrong? And she said, I want you to be careful. And what Julie said is, I am careful. First thing every morning I put on sunscreen and I'm always wearing hats. But she said, you know what? You need to be aware of something. Your body has 4 spots where there were precancerous moles. And she said, something's coming back and I need to check it. Now, Julie is extremely fair in complexion. And she said, my mother always, when I was growing up, tried to make me aware. You're a redhead. You've got very, very fair skin. You need to stay out of the sun. Don't tan. Well, how many of us, when we're young, listen to our wise parents? Not many of us. And Julie wasn't any different. So she said she would just go after having that golden tan. And eventually, she thought she was going to get it. But instead of getting the golden tan, she turned a brilliant, brilliant red. And so she said she knew then that she couldn't handle the sun. She finally listened to her mother. Well, here she is years later in the dermatologist's office, and she said, I don't understand it. She would get so upset because she was so fair. And she said, this is just something that she needed to be at peace with. And so she said, I just need to remember that I have to take care of myself. So she said, I just am very grateful now for my freckles, and if I have to be out in the sun, I just take all of the extra precautions. And these are some of the precautions that are recommended. If you're very fair, just actually it's good common sense. You don't want to bake and burn your body because it's not a real good thing to do. But remember your ABCs, and this is what the ABCs stand for. It stands for asymmetry. The shape of one half of a mole, if you notice a mole in your body, doesn't match the other. Watch for a border. Mole edges are uneven, scalloped, or notched. And you watch for the color. Apparently, there are various colors that appear throughout the mole. And doctors have also added D for diameter since melanomas. Cancerous lesions tend to be larger than a pencil eraser, and they tend to be elevated. They're not flat. They're elevated. And it appears to raise from the skin itself. So they say it's a good idea to take a preventative stance and to look once a month to see if there's any new growths or any new skin changes, and check your eyes and fingernails And if you are a person that has a tendency towards skin cancer, go in and have a checkup maybe once a year. They say, due to statistics that have been run, 1 out of 5 Americans will develop skin cancer. And melanoma is the most dangerous form of skin cancer and in an advanced stage can be fatal. And fortunately, it rarely strikes without warning, and when found early, it can be readily treated. Now, precautions such as wearing year-round broad-spectrum sunscreen, staying out of tanning salons, and wearing UV-blocking sunglasses can help reduce your risk. Now, there is a Skin Cancer Foundation, and you are welcome to go to their website. They're located in New York. You can go to skincancer.org. skincancer.org if you have any questions regarding this. And this is something that I think is very, very important. I had a very, very special lady that I knew a few years back, and she contracted melanoma, and she had gotten it because of using tanning booths extensively. And what happened is that she ended up passing away from this, but was very deeply involved in all kinds of research relative to melanoma. And she did a number of things that doctors just couldn't believe that she was able to survive the extensiveness of what happened to her physically with this. This disease really did do a number on her physically and eventually caused her to pass away. But regardless, be wise here. Understand that you are the one that has to pay attention to what's going on with your body. Take care of yourself. You don't need to have this golden tan. You know, they have some of these creams that you can put on that'll change your skin color and make you look like you've been sitting out in the sun for years and years and it just belongs on you. Use something like that if you want. But it's okay if you are not that golden brown. And there's a reason for it, because it can cause, especially if you're extremely fair, it can cause some problems. So be wise and be prudent and take care of yourself. We want you to be around for a long, long time. This is Donna Sebo, and I know we are not going to be taking a break today. I do want to let you know that we have some wonderful, wonderful guests come up. And tomorrow, if you're into herbs, all kinds of natural products, we're going to be talking about ginseng. This is considered a divine root in Asian culture. David Taylor is going to be my guest tomorrow. And, oh, is this man informed? This has been a passion of his. And I'm just so delighted we're going to be able to share so much good information with you. So that's tomorrow. And then on Wednesday, we're going to be talking with Mary Getton. We're going to be communicating with orcas. Yes, she has put together material about her experiences with these fascinating creatures of the sea. And these animals are just wonderful to know about. But she gives us an insight into these wonderful animals that I think will be just phenomenal. And then on Thursday, we're going to have an open mic day, so I will not be having any guests on that day. The mics will be open for any phone calls. And then on Friday, we're going to be talking with Jared Rosen. We're going to teach you how to flip. Yes, how to flip your life around so that you have more empowerment for what you want and how you want to get things changed in your life. It's a wonderful lineup of guests. Be sure to tell your friends. Also, remember, on bbsradio.com, all of you that are listening, you know how to get to us. But know that you can go in. We're putting the archives together, so you're going to. We've got some of them up. There's more that are coming online, and all of these are available for your listening pleasure. And if you have comments about the show, if there are things that you would like to know more about, BBS Radio provides that comment opportunity. Go in, take advantage of that. Give us your comments. Do you like the guest? What do you feel about the programming? What would you like to hear? What would you like to know? We want to hear from you. So if you have a comment about the Donna Sebo Show, just go to that comment box and go ahead and put in what you have to say, because, again, we do love to hear from you, and we want to be able to give you the best programming possible. Donna Sebo here, and I've got something special to share with you. This is a recipe. It's a maple mustard pork chop with apple corn salad. How does that sound? Well, if you're wanting to find out more, I'm going to be happy to give it to you, because this is a perfect summer dinner special. and it can be fixed on the grill, and you don't have to heat up your kitchen. Now, pure maple syrup is something that's recommended for this recipe, not your maple-flavored pancake syrup, because it will break down. The flavor won't hold because it's artificial. So you want to have some real maple syrup. Now, here's what you're going to need. You're going to need 4 ears of fresh corn. Of course, you want all the husks removed. You want them nice and clean. So that's 4 ears of fresh corn, 2 tablespoons of olive oil, 2 tablespoons of oil, 2 teaspoons of garlic powder, 2 teaspoons of garlic powder, 1.5 teaspoons of cracked pepper, 1.5 teaspoons of cracked pepper, 1 teaspoon of salt, 1 teaspoon of salt, 6 pork loin rib chops. You need them about 1 inch thick. It comes to about 3 pounds. So you want 6 of those wonderfully delightful pork loin rib chops, and I like mine without the bone. You might like yours with the bone. So however you do it, just make sure you got 6. You need 1/4 cup of maple syrup. That's the real stuff now. Don't forget. 1/4 cup of Dijon mustard. And then you're going to need 2 Gala apples, cored and cut into 1/2-inch pieces. And if you can't get the Gala apple, then I'd recommend using your Granny Smith. They still will have a delicious flavor. Or whatever your favorite apple is, but you want a good cooking apple. 1/3 cup of bottled Italian vinaigrette salad dressing, 1/3 cup of the bottled Italian vinaigrette salad dressing, and 1 tablespoon of chopped fresh tarragon. Now, this is how it goes, sweet and simple. Of course, you want your grill nice and hot. If you want to do this under the broiler, you can do that too, but you want to make sure they're preheated. And you want to grill your corn first. You want to turn it occasionally until it's nice and tender. It takes about 8 to 12 minutes, then let it cool. And in the meantime, what you do while your corn's cooking, combine your oil, your garlic, your pepper, and salt, and you want to brush it over the sides of the chops. Then you want your syrup and mustard combined. You want to put that to the side. And then you want to grill your chops for about 4 minutes, turn them, and then you want to start brushing them with your reserved mixture. You continue to grill them about 4 minutes, turn, brush with the mixture, grill about 2 minutes, turn. Grill until your meat is no longer pink near the bone or in the center, which is a few more minutes. Then you want to take your kernels from your corn cobs. You want to slice them away from the cob itself. Combine your corn, the apples, the vinaigrette dressing, tarragon, and the remaining pepper, and just mix that lightly, and you serve that with your chops. Mm-mm. Good stuff with your, you know, sun-made tea out there. All you have to do is just sit back and relax. And you will just have a marvelous, marvelous meal. Maple mustard pork chops with apple corn salad. Sound good? Mm-hmm. Maple's one of my favorite flavorings. Well, I know we are just about out of time here, and it's so delightful to have spent this time with you. I want to remind you that tomorrow we're going to be talking with David Taylor about ginseng, the divine root. And we're going to have all kinds of information regarding ginseng's history, as well as some recipes if you are interested in it medicinally or for just other preparations. Ginseng tea. There's all kinds of ways that this can be used. And also, I want you to know that I am putting up the information about my upcoming authors on bbsradio.com. When you go into the Donna Sebo Show, you can find out. You can tap on the link that will give you the schedule of all the shows coming up. And we go Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. And you'll see all of the dates and the people that are going to be the guests. And I'll be adding to that for the upcoming month of September. We just have so many wonderfully talented people, and I feel so privileged that they're my guests. Remember, always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. Don't ever forget, your light is a very special one, and you've got to keep it really turned on so that it's going to be able to bring all of what you want in life to you and be able to let you shine your wisdom on other people as well. This is Donna Sebo. I wish you well. Have a fabulous day, and I'll be back with you tomorrow, same time, same place, right here on bbsradio.com. Bye for now.